Back there. If you're interested, you have any questions, let's line up in order. Again, this is not an opportunity for you to preach. This is an opportunity for you to ask the various people. Well, first one up, okay. Introduce yourself and then ask the appropriate person.
You pointed out the responsibilities of the state to protect the innocent. Does the state have the right to protect its own territorial integrity in the name of needing to protect the innocent? Without protecting its territorial integrity, without protecting the monopoly on power within its territory, how can a state exist? You see the logic. It's no good if these guys tell me they'll protect me from the terrorists and take my taxes, if those guys also tell me they're going to take my taxes and protect me against the terrorists and these other guys. There has to be a monopoly on power. Otherwise, states can't exist. And do they have the right to protect their monopoly on power?
I guess the point that I was making in that last part of my address is that evangelicals are sometimes reticent to talk about the situations we wish we didn't have to deal with. Situations in which there are real threats, in which the state must exercise defense roles. The whole theory of monopoly of power and so on, there are political theorists who could do better in answering that question than I could. What I want to focus on is that I believe that the state does have that responsibility, and that even the most peace-oriented Christian statesmen and stateswomen who end up in those roles recognize that they have the supervisory responsibility or implementation responsibility of security roles. Now, what I tried to say at the first part of my talk is what has happened in the U.S. setting is a massive bloat of that entire apparatus outside of democratic control, and there's a lot, that's really where we put a lot of our focus, and we should. But when I was on that airplane, I was reminded of the more raw issue in its more basic form, and I wanted to be sure that that got addressed today.
Mine is on the very same point that David made. I thought your talk really pivoted right at that point. You said churches can stand for nonviolence, but all the governments know that they need to be able to defend their people by military force. But I wonder if you wouldn't really want to restate that by saying that a government or a president, whoever, has a responsibility for peace and justice and liberty and consent to the governed, a whole spectrum, which in rare cases might mean you would defend the country against attack the way Article 5 of the UN Charter says. But mostly, the president's going to do better if the president doesn't get the country engaged in war, but does some peacemaking initiatives and does some justice for the people and stuff like that, which would then mean that churches, including pacifists, have a relevant message for churches, for states, when they can say, you know, you could do peacemaking better this way and get yourself engaged in war less often if you did this and this and this. Wouldn't that open the door to more Christian ethics, church witness, peacemaking kind of thing if you defined the state that way?
Yes, should I stay down here?
Is your mic working?
No, I don't hear any mic. Do you hear any mic? Yes, actually. Okay, yeah. Yes, I don't think there's anything you just said that I disagree with. I think that we so much focus on the peacemaking side of it, and we need to, that sometimes we don't really want to deal with what happens when peacemaking fails, and or when you deal with somebody who you get to that last resort situation. But yes, you are right, I think, in what you said, all those points. Yes.
My question is for you, Lisa. Thank you. I'm Jared Holsing. I'm an assistant pastor in the local area here with the Wesleyan Church. And I have a biblical question. When we talk about suffering servant, that functions within the context of Old Testament law where there is capital punishment. So suffering servant is more in the redemptive context, not in the legal context. And then Luke 3:14, John the Baptist is advising soldiers to not harass anyone, but not stop being soldiers. Mm-hmm. And then Jesus, at the Last Supper, there are swords in the room. Disciples are carrying swords mm-hmm. at the Last Supper. So within that sort of context, I'm just wondering how you see the sort of the biblical picture mm-hmm. of capital punishment in the Old Testament, advice to soldiers, swords still being carried by disciples even into the Last Supper, and how that affects the way we view the sword mm-hmm. in Scripture.
You raise really great questions. I don't know, is this on? Okay, great. You raise really great questions, and they are directly from the text. They are questions that the text begs. Let me say where I'm rooted is really in the story of Shalom and the breaking of it and the restoration of it. And so the axis, I just wrote a piece just recently that was on Q Ideas and Sojourners and then Huffington Post, where I said, the axis of my political engagement really revolves around Scripture and around Shalom in particular, the biblical concept of Shalom. And so what I go to immediately is, okay, that's all true. It's true. There was capital punishment in the Old Testament. It's true that there were swords at the Last Supper. It's true that Jesus didn't tell soldiers not to be soldiers. But at the same time, I ask the question, were there swords in the garden? Was there a military? Is there a mention of a military in Genesis 1 or 2? Because that is pre-fall. That is before original sin came into the world. That is before. And that, I believe, is actually the world that God is bringing us back to. So the question for me is not a question of how do we compromise within the world? We have to ask that question. I'm not saying there should be no military. In fact, I very much agree with everything that Glenn and David just said, and was challenged by a class that I took on international policymaking in the Persian Gulf when I was in grad school. And I had to play the role of Brzezinski in the Iran hostage crisis. I literally had to fight his case in that class, and I did, and I got an A, right? And so I do believe that there is a place for that. But my question is, as Christians, as people who are trying to follow the Jesus way, who are under now the dominion of God, the reign of God, the picture of what does the reign of God look like? And the purest picture that we get in Scripture is Genesis 1 and 2. And what that reign looks like is one, and also Micah 4, 1 through 5. Where they now take their swords and make them into plowshares. They take instruments of death and mold them into instruments of life. They take their spears and take them into pruning hooks. And there is fear no more, and people will learn war no more. So that is what God is moving us toward. If that is what God is moving us toward, even in the Old Testament, then I have to believe that the fact that there's a sword in the room, the fact that there is capital punishment in the Old Testament is kind of like the fig leaves or in the garden. It's kind of like it's between the now and the not yet. It's something that God allows in the meantime in order to cover over our shame until the time when we come to the place where there is only one tree, the tree of life, and all of the leaves of the garden are for the healing of the nations.
Yes. This is a question for Mr. Tunnicliffe. I'm John Washburn, convener of the American NGO Coalition for the International Criminal Court. Mr. Tunnicliffe, is the work of the International Criminal Court compatible with the work of evangelicals as you see it? And if that is so, what would be a good way for supporters of the court to encourage it to come together with evangelicals?
I have to say, that's not a question I've been asked before. We do work with other groups, the United Nations and others. I think we very closely with them, actually. And, of course, we need a world of justice. And, there are deficiencies within the court system, but it's one of the key instruments of justice that we have in the world. So I think there is a way of understanding and working together more closely. And I think there are bodies within our community, for instance, the Advocates International, which is a network of 30,000 lawyer, Christian lawyers in 150 countries. It's kind of a scary thought, actually, but I think they could actually engage more deeply with you at some that level. So, yeah, I think there's some be worth interesting having that conversation. So,
thank you very much.
Please.
Hello, thank you. My name is Alan Johnson. I'm not sure whether I asked this to David or Sharon, but thank you for your talks, all of you. My question, I'm concerned about how we can get trapped into terminology. You know, one time the Department of Defense was, what, the Department of War? Now it's defense, so that immediately puts us into that kind of context. Yet I can remember when it really struck me back in 2000 during one of the presidential debates, and the candidate at that time, George W. Bush, talked about the military and the budget and having a strong defend the national interest. And I could understand, David, your talk about the airplane. And I understand traffic laws and having somebody who snatched the purse, you know, and go after them and get that back, you know. But then we're talking about a bloated military budget, which seems to be, I think, defending some type of empire. And so I'd like to say, I just ask, where do we draw the line of what national interest is? And within that parameters, please.
And I would just say that's the right question to ask. I believe that, well, I'll go with David Stockman, who says we've developed global policeman imperialism, and we have a military budget that matches that project. It's probably even more than is needed for that project, but that's conceivable. And so the proper conversation is, what are we attempting to defend, and what is it legitimate to pay for that? And then, of course, as Glenn mentioned, what are the many, many other ways one can advance security besides the use of the military, right? So I think that conversation has not been engaged nationally, because after a while, having the most powerful military in the history of the world becomes a point of national pride, and it becomes a point of national identity, and it's how we reassure ourselves that we're still the world's number one nation, despite all evidence to the contrary in terms of our sliding economic indicators and well-being indicators and so on. So it has become a totem, a symbol of strength and power, and nobody dare touch it and die, Democrat or Republican. And I think Christians know a little bit about idolatry and a little bit about raising questions about idols. So I think that economic stress and deficits and so on ought to provide an occasion for us to put everything on the table for reconsideration. I've been disturbed that we don't seem to be able to do that very well on the military yet. So.
Peter will have to be the last person given a question for the sake of time. Thank you for your flexibility. Peter.
Thanks, Rick. Peter Sensenig, I'm a PhD student at Fuller Seminary. Since the name of this summit is Evangelicals for Peace, I'm wondering, this is for any of you, how would you describe your approach as uniquely evangelical?
Can I begin? I think that, and I begin because I have to go. Please forgive me. I overbooked, and so I will be back later on around lunchtime. But I'll just begin by my approach. And that's actually the point of that article that I mentioned, is that its axis is Scripture, and I think that there are four markers of evangelicals according to church historians, and one of them, one of the primary ones, is biblicism and the centrality of Scripture and the authority of Scripture. And so also the transformative power of the cross, the actual transformative power of the cross, not only for the individual, but also for society. And so I think that we cannot even begin to engage an understanding or philosophy or theology of war if you are evangelical without considering that, the transformative power of the cross and Jesus and the resurrection. If you don't really believe, if you don't believe that there is an option without war, if you believe war is your best option, then you really have to reconsider whether or not you believe in the power of the resurrection. Because that was transformative, and it came not because Jesus went and pounded anybody, but because they pounded him. So anyway, I have to go, and I'll be right back.
Jeff or David, anything briefly as Kate comes up to give the last 5 minutes?
Quick story. I was in Indonesia, just met with the Indonesian president, and was in a press conference. Very first question was, what's World Evangelical Alliance position around Israel and the defense of Israel? And so I sought to respond to that in a broad way. A specific question then came and said, well, what about evangelicals buying tanks and for the Israelis? I said, I'm not sure if I can confirm that. I certainly hope not. But there's a perception of who we are as evangelicals that's driven by sound bites coming out of, primarily out of media, out of this country, that brings a disservice and doesn't describe who we are as evangelicals. I'm simply saying part of this is, in this context in the United States, is important because it allows us to begin to say we are defined by a broader issues biblically than what's been the narrow casting of some through the media. So for us, it's about a rehabilitation of the word evangelical as we engage. It's not that evangelicals haven't engaged in peace building and making through the years, but this, I think, is important in this context, in this country, to send a message around the world. So that's...